Welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, featuring programs from the golden age of radio. Mark Levonier, your host, bringing you into an hour of mystery. Later on, it's the adventures of Philip Marlowe with Gerald Moore in the lead, but right now, the adventures of Ellery Queen. This episode from Armed Forces Radio, a rebroadcast of its original airing on NBC on September 7th, 1947, the story called The Number 31.
And now, Ellery Queen tells the story of a mysterious international figure suspected of diamond smuggling, Number 31.
Just a minute, Charlie. Inspector.
Huh? Who is it, Vili?
A radio phone. Charlie says some guy's calling the police department from the steamship at G at sea.
So I'm elected, huh? Inspector Queen speaking.
You kept me waiting.
Hi, Kip. Who is this?
George Arcaris.
Oh, yes, Mr. Arcaris. Well, what can I do for you?
You and your police and your customs officials can let me alone. That's what you can do for me, Inspector, whoever you are.
Now, I don't get you, Mr. Arcaris. If you're on shipboard in mid-Atlantic, you...
You can let me alone when the ship docks in New York.
Oh, expecting trouble with the customs, Mr. Arcaris?
Very humorous. 3 times now I've been searched in your customs like a common criminal. If it occurs this time, I shall make the most vigorous representations to my government. Do you understand me? Inspector, what is your name?
I understand you.
He's going to make trouble, Inspector, huh?
That's what he says, Vili.
Is this a private fight, Dad, or can anyone get in on it?
Oh, that was a bird named George Arcaris, Ellery.
He's from the Near East.
Yeah, and he has plenty of connections.
Arcaris, of course.
What's your interest in him?
Well, son, about a year ago, we got a tip he was smuggling diamonds in. We passed the tip to customs. They gave him the business.
But no diamonds, I take it.
No diamonds. Still, after Arcaris sailed back to his homeland... Some stuff turned up around New York that seemed to jibe with our tip.
The same thing happened on his next 2 trips, Maestro.
Now he calls from mid-ocean to say that if he's bothered again, he'll make a diplomatic issue of it.
Well, if he's innocent, you can't blame him.
Listen, Miss Porter, this Arcaris is an international mystery man.
And he's suspected of everything from espionage to murder, but never any proof.
Well, it certainly doesn't keep him out of cafe society. He's always being wined and dined by people like Pip Istrom and Sue Mounting and that crowd.
Oh. Who's been passing these tips along, Dad?
Oh, they've been coming in by way of the underground. Vili, get me Zeke.
Yes, sir, right away.
Of course, it's occurred to you, Dad, that Arcaris may be smuggling the diamonds in through a Confederate.
Sure, it's occurred to us, but
that's right. Yeah.
What can you do? It's one of those things that...
Yeah, just a minute, please.
Here's simple enough.
Here's ZK, Inspector.
Zach, anything come in on George Arcaris? Yes, I know. Well, I just got a notion about that. I'll call you right back. There's been another tip. Now, listen, Ellery. We must make sure that Arcaris isn't slipping the ice to a co-worker to carry off. Now, would you make sure for us?
It's a delicate situation, Maestro.
If you tell us he hasn't passed anything to a pal, we'll search Arcaris in customs, Ellery.
I'd have to board the Aegea quite a bit before she docks, Dad.
That'll be a cinch now. I can arrange it with the port and customs people.
All right.
Now, look here. You go out Sunday with the pilot and mingle with the passengers.
Wait a minute, there he is.
Now, Vili, be ready to take Arcaris over from Ellery.
Okay.
All right, get going.
All right.
So that's Mr. Arcaris.
Let's get closer, Nikki.
Why, Inspector, there's Pip Istrom and Susu Mounting, his fiancée.
His society friends, huh?
Beep, Susu, here I am.
Susu, there he is.
George,
hi, George.
Darling, hi.
I'll see you as soon as I'm finished with the customs.
Don't let him push you around, George.
Don't worry.
Well, Ellery,
nothing doing.
He didn't pass it.
I'm positive. Haven't had my eyes off him. If he's smuggling anything, Dad, it's in his luggage or on him.
Well, that means a body search. And I better go tell Zach. Thanks, son.
Phone me at home, Dad, will you?
Uh-huh.
I wonder if they'll find anything, Ellery.
I wonder. Nothing, eh?
Not a blasted thing, son. Vili swears Arcaris didn't pass anything to anyone from the gangway to the customs ship.
Arcaris raising Cain?
He's calling Washington right now. I guess those tips are phonies, and we fell for them.
Yeah. Keep me informed, Dad. Oh, Nikki.
The inspector?
Yes, and it's a washout.
Uh-oh. Oh, by the way, Ellery, there's a Mrs. Prine waiting to see you. She's terribly concerned about her son.
Her son?
Well, all right?
Oh, as long as she's here already, yeah.
Come in, Mrs. Prine.
Yes, please, come in, Mrs. Prine, and sit down, won't you?
Oh, Mr. Quinn, it's about Arthur, my boy.
Yes?
He's missing. He didn't come home yesterday.
Well, suppose you tell me all about it.
I'm a widow. I'm sickly, and Arthur supports me.
Where was Arthur supposed to be coming home from, Mrs. Prine?
From his job. He's got a butlin job over on Park Avenue, employed by Mr. Istrom.
Ellery.
Oh, the buddy of our good friend, Nicky. Please go on, Mrs. Prine.
Well, every Saturday for 3 years, Mr. Queen, that boy's come straight home from Park Avenue with his salary. Here it is Sunday, and he ain't home yet.
Have you called Mr. Istrom?
Oh, yes, sir, yesterday evening. But he said Arthur had left at the usual time, saying he was going right home. I don't know what I'll do if Arthur don't show up by tonight.
Mrs. Prine is afraid he'll lose his job, Ellery.
Mr. Istrom's awful strict. Every morning, Arthur has to have Mr. Istrom's breakfast ready by 9 o'clock. Monday mornings, Arthur always gets there by 8:30, just so Mr. Istrom can eat on time.
Did Istrom offer any possible explanation, Mrs. Prine?
Well, he said not to worry. But I don't know, Mr. Queen. It don't sound like Arthur.
Hmm. Have you notified the police?
Oh, no, sir. Mr. Istrom wouldn't like that. That's why I come to you, Mr. Queen.
Yes. Well, now, you go home and stop worrying, Mrs. Prine. I'll make the inquiries.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Queen.
That's all right.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Pip Istrom's butler. And today, George Arcaris came in. Funny coincidence.
Nicky, get me the Missing Persons Bureau.
Here she is, Ellery.
Hmm? Oh. Good morning, Mrs. Prine.
Morning, Mr. Queen. Miss Porter.
Morning.
I got down here just as fast as I could.
Mrs. Prine, I think we've found Arthur.
Oh, you have? Well, where is he?
Mrs. Prine.
Yes, sir?
I'm afraid we have some dreadful news for you. This is the city mortuary.
What, sir?
This is the morgue, Mrs. Prine. Nicky.
It's all right, sir. It's all right.
Lean on me, Mrs. Prine.
Do you think that... you're up to identifying Arthur officially for us, Mrs. Prine.
I want to see my boy.
Nicky.
I know, Ellery.
All right, Mrs. Prine. Sergeant.
Right, Maestro.
Like.
His body was taken out of the East River at 5 o'clock this morning.
Arthur never did a wrong thing in his life. Only maybe played 10 cents on the numbers once in a while. He won $20 last month playing the number 31.
What?
Yes, sir. He liked that number, 31. Been playing it for most a year. Do I go home now?
Sergeant, take Mrs. Prine home, will you?
Yeah. Go on, Mrs. Prine. Easy. Come on.
I think I'd like a cup of coffee, Ellery.
Then Pip Istrom is going to have to give it to you.
Istrom? But, Ellery, it's so early in the morning. It's only 7:15.
This can't wait, Nicky. There's a connection between Arthur's death and George Arcaris. That number, 31.
You mean just because Arthur played 31 all the time in the numbers
game? The number
game,
of Arcaris's cabin on the Aegeo was also 31. Come on, Nicky.
I can't see anyone at this hour. I'm just having my breakfast.
Mr. Istrom, your butler is dead.
Arthur? Dead? Well, come in.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Please forgive the appearance of my apartment. Arthur is... was the only servant I employed. Dan, that's something of a blow. He was a jewel. Won't you sit down?
Thanks, Mr. Istrom, but we...
Mind if I have another cup of coffee?
Not at all.
Join me?
No, thanks.
Arthur's mother phoned me Saturday night, but naturally... How did he die?
He died of a cerebral fracture. There's a bruise on his jaw, and the back of his head is not pretty.
And then his body was dumped in the East River, like a sack of garbage.
In a word, Mr. Istrom, Arthur was murdered.
That's clumsy of me. Well, see here, Queen, do the police think I did it or some such nonsense? The last time I saw Arthur was Saturday evening when he left here perfectly all right.
I take it that your friend, George Arcaris, knew Arthur.
Sure. What has Arcaris to do with Arthur's death, Queen?
That, Mr. Istrom, is what I propose to find out.
George, he only got into the States yesterday morning.
Arthur may not have been murdered until yesterday afternoon. Immersion in water, you see, often makes it difficult to fix the exact time of death.
Now, look here. I'm getting a little bit bored with all this. My fiancée, Miss Mounting, and I have known Mr. Arcaris for a long time, and I'm quite...
31.
Sure... I beg your pardon.
I said 31. Does the number 31 mean anything to you, Mr. Istrom?
Not a thing.
Oh, then I'll let you return to your breakfast. Mickey?
Now you're way off, son. What possible connection could there be?
I don't know, Dad, but there is one.
All on account of a number 31 and a coincidence.
Just the same, I'm going to see Arcaris.
Gallery, no.
Why?
Now lay off Arcaris, will you? You don't know the stench he's made. Now, please, son.
Okay. But, Dad, I think you're making a big mistake.
And that seemed to be the end of the diamond smuggling case. And of the Arthur Prime case, too. The police got nowhere on it, and Ellery got grumpier every day. Then 2 weeks later, it was a Sunday.
Nikki, is that you?
Uh-huh.
Oh.
In my Sunday best. Ellery, what's the matter?
The Aegea, it's sailing today.
So what?
George Arcaris is sailing on it.
I suppose he is.
Nikki, we can just make it.
Make what?
The Aegea. I just solved it, Nikki. Come on.
I hope you know what you're doing, Mr. Queen.
Trust me, Captain.
You hope.
Queen. Captain Dillier, Mr. Arcaris. Open your cabin door, please.
Yes? What is it, Captain? Where are these people?
Mr. Arcaris, would you mind if this gentleman searches your cabin?
Search. I mind very definitely, Captain.
Perhaps if I explained. Mr. Arcaris, it's my theory that this cabin contains a hiding place.
Hiding place? Of what?
Of some diamonds.
Oh, I see. Formerly, I've been accused of smuggling diamonds into the United States. Now I am accused of smuggling them out. Is that it?
Not exactly. But you will admit, Mr. Arcaris, won't you, that it's a very odd coincidence you're always booking Cabin 31 in the Aegea, both coming and going?
I'm just demented. Very well.
Go ahead, sir. I can't hold up the ship, Mr. Queen. We sail in 10 minutes.
Ellery, 10 minutes?
One side, Nikki.
You'll have to hurry, Mr. Queen.
It is a pity my good friends, Mr. Istrom and Miss Mounting, did not stay on board long enough to witness this spectacle.
So Istrom and Miss Mounting were here, Mr. Arcaris. Here in your cabin?
You know them? Yes, Mr. Queen. They always see me off.
That's very interesting, Arcaris, because the steel support of this bunk comes out, revealing a very effective hiding place.
What?
Why, it's big enough to hide a fortune in diamonds.
But, Mr. Queen, it's empty.
Certainly, Captain, but it was full of diamonds when the Aegea docked.
But Ellery, he was searched when he got off the ship.
Arcaris left the diamonds on board, Nikki. He never carried them off when the ship made port, but he made sure always to get Cabin 31 for the return trip. You heard him just now. Pip Istrom and Susu Mounting always see him off. Visitors to the ship on its outgoing voyage. Such visitors are not searched when they leave. One of them carried the diamonds off just a few minutes ago.
Stand very still.
Oh. My error.
Do not move, please. Not even a little.
Very good.
Oh, the swine. Locked.
Ellery, look here, through the porthole. He's running down the gangway just as they're pulling it in.
Never mind our carriage, Nicky. We've got to get to Wistrom's. Captain, get us off your ship. And so, Mr. Wistrom, I will trouble you for those diamonds.
The Queen, they have nothing to do with our carriage. My fiancée, Miss Mounting, did turn some jewels over to me this afternoon, yes. But...
Oh, she did?
Yes, she often does. Susu was very popular before our engagement, you know, with some extremely wealthy gentry. She gambles a little, I'm afraid, and she turned some of their gifts over to me for disposal. You know, my father made his money in South African diamonds. I still have some of Father's connection. Do you doubt my word?
Are you as big an idiot as you sound, Istrom? Your precious Susu has been smuggling diamonds into the United States for your friend Arcaris and getting you to turn them into cash.
That's a lie, Queen. That's a filthy lie.
Oh, Ellery, watch yourself!
Semper, Mr. Istrom.
Sorry.
Wow. You knocked him out, Ellery. He's out cold.
Yes. Now to find those diamonds.
Don't bother.
Huh?
Susu Mounting.
I've got them. Mr. Queen, isn't it?
You know, Miss Marty, that gun is probably loaded. You sure you know what you're doing?
Oh, stop it. Now, you're both going to march out of here and go down to the street. You'll pretend nothing's wrong. You'll get into my car. Drive it. I'll be in the back with this thing pointing at you. And you'll drive out to the country.
Sounds cozy.
Nicky. Shut up.
Where are we going, Susu?
To a little hideaway cottage used by George Arcaris.
Arcaris?
Get going.
You are an idiot, Susu. You bring them here. Why did you not shoot them in bits apart?
Well, I'm not as used to shooting people as you are, George. I'm getting out of here.
Stay where you are. Perhaps it is just as well, Mr. Queen. I owe you something. Personally. Now that Susu has brought you here, we will make the best of it, huh? We have the diamonds. This is Pip Istrom's pistol. We will concoct a plot.
Ellery.
It's all right, Nicky. Arcaris wouldn't be that foolish.
Foolish? This cottage is owned by Pip Istrom, Mr. Queen. An accommodation to his good friend, George. But nothing on paper, you understand. So we will bury you here. By the time you are found, Mr. Istrom, who has been a dupe throughout, we'll have some explaining to do.
No, don't. George, wait. Wait till I go away with you.
My dear Miss Mounting, we smuggle diamonds together. We will commit murder together.
Oh, no.
Or would you rather join them? I give you 5 seconds, Susu.
Get it over with. Quick.
Duck, Nicky. I've got his gun, Dad.
Nice shooting, Billy.
Yes, stand still, girlfriend.
Take your paws off me. It's Mr. Istrom. Pip.
You filth.
Has anybody got a drink?
You've done your last drinking for some time, Miss Mounting. And I don't think, Arcaris, that you'll smuggle any more diamonds like these into the United States for some time.
You will get me a physician and my consulate at once.
Sure. Well, son, another narrow squeak.
I got Mr. Istrom to thank, Maestro. He came to after the Mounting woman hustled you out and phoned us pronto.
I heard Susu's confession, Mr. Queen. It quite restored my sanity.
Thanks for saving our lives, Istrom. Well, Dad, now...
Ellery, let's get out of here.
Nicky, don't you want to know who killed Mrs. Prine's son, Arthur?
The murder of Mr. Istrom's butler.
You mean, son, the two cases are connected?
Oh, yes, Dad.
All right, sir, what gives?
Listen, every morning for 3 years, Arthur Prine prepared his employer's breakfast by 9 o'clock. On Monday mornings, Arthur always got to Mr. Istrom's apartment by 8:30, Mrs. Prine told us, Nicky. Just so Mr. Istrom can eat on time. Now, Nicky, do you recall the morning Mrs. Prine identified Arthur's body at the morgue?
Yes, it was a Monday morning.
And what time was it when we left the morgue to go to Mr. Istrom's apartment?
Very early. I think I said it was 7:15.
That's right. We took a cab. We went directly from the morgue to Istrom's Park Avenue apartment. So when we saw Istrom, no more than 15 to 20 minutes could have elapsed. In other words, it was around 7:30 in the morning. And what was Istrom doing when we called on him at that hour?
Eating his breakfast.
At 7:30 a.m. But this was breaking a fixed habit of years. Why, on that particular Monday morning, did not Pip Istrom wait for his man Arthur to turn up to prepare breakfast for him?
Because he knew Arthur was dead, Ellery?
Well, Dad, the only ones who knew Arthur was dead at that time were ourselves and Arthur's mother. Arthur's body hadn't been fished out of the East River until 5 a.m., hadn't been identified by his mother until 7:15 a.m. 15 minutes before we found Istrom eating a breakfast he himself must have prepared, since Arthur was his only servant. There is only one way Istrom could have known Arthur was dead, and that's if Istrom had killed him. Correct, Istrom?
Correct. Yeah, but, Maestro, why? And what did the number 31 have to do with it?
Well, for some time, Arthur, who had a weakness for playing the numbers game, had been playing 31, because he had noticed that your good friend Arcaris always occupied cabin 31 in the Aegea. Arthur took that as a hunch, as so many numbers players do. But that last Saturday, Arthur suddenly realized that Arcaris wasn't using cabin 31 in the Aegea just because he liked it. He had probably noticed also that each time after Arcaris sailed in cabin 31 in the Aegea, your fiancé, Istrom, invariably deposited some diamonds with you. And your butler made the connection you were too blind to make. He told you that Saturday afternoon, and you must...
I was so outraged, I lost my temper and hit Arthur in the jaw with all my strength. He fell hard and fractured his head on the floor. I didn't mean to kill him. I hit his body then, in the middle of the night. I took it down the service elevator into my car and disposed of it in the river.
I'm afraid, Istrom, that you've been your own worst enemy throughout. Too infatuated with Susu Mounting to see what she really was, too hot-headed to control that murderous temper of yours, and too foolish to call the police when Arthur died and rely on the simple truth. Now you'll have to face a jury under very different circumstances.
It'll be your own fault, Istrom, if they don't believe your story. Sergeant, take him in, too.
The Adventures of Ellery Queen, on Tuned to Yesterday, an Armed Forces Radio Service rebroadcast of that NBC program, first heard on September 7th, 1947. And the distinct sound of the organ that was the glue of the show was performed by Chet Kingsbury. One of his earlier radio works included the American School of the Air, based out of New York, where he served as narrator. You're listening to An Hour of Mystery on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark LeVanier. And now on to the adventures of Philip Marlowe, under the direction of the famed Norman MacDonald, responsible for Gunsmoke and many other impressive series during radio's yesteryear. The CBS broadcast called The Heart of Gold, from October 24th, 1948.
When I got the crisp $50 bill in advance, I figured my client had a heart of gold. But after I was beat up, double-crossed, and shot at, I realized just how hard a heart of gold can be.
From the pen of Raymond Chandler, outstanding author of crime fiction, comes his most famous character as CBS presents The Adventures of Philip Marlowe. And now, with Gerald Moore starred as Philip Marlowe, we bring you tonight's unusual story, The Heart of Gold.
I had spent the day trying to decide how to spend the day and finally convinced myself Sunday afternoon was a good time to catch up with neglected bookkeeping. But I only got as far as the office door because a special delivery letter was stuck in the mail slot. I ripped it open and watched a crisp $50 bill flutter to the floor. Pinning it down with my toe, I turned to the letter, which was dated Saturday. Dear Mr. Marlowe, kindly investigate the party who lives at 1903 North Ogden Street to find out if his name is really Elliot Perdue and what his occupation is. Then please come to my residence at 5 tomorrow, Sunday. I live at the home of a friend, Arthur Stewart, 33 Lemonwood Drive in Bel Air. I sincerely hope that $50 will be a sufficient retainer. Truly yours, Helen Asher. Judging from the tone of her letter, it was obvious that Helen Asher didn't hire private detectives very often. Nevertheless, I glanced at my watch, which said I had to work very fast, and I headed for 1903 North Ogden. It turned out to be a small house near Selma Street. I got out of my car and walked up to the door. Good afternoon, sir. You the resident here?
That's right. What do you want?
I represent the Dr. Potter poll of public opinion. I'd like to ask you a few questions regarding...
Sorry, but I don't have any opinions to express.
Oh, even the opinions of a man with no opinions are important to us. Now, let's just let me step inside here and get out my notebook. There we are.
All right, but make it fast.
Right. Now, what is your occupation?
I'm an investment broker.
With which firm?
I'm independent.
I see. And what is your name, sir?
What do you need my name for?
Well, for my personal records in case I have to come back.
Elliot Perdue.
Uh-huh. Do you have any hobbies other than horse racing?
What do you mean?
Those dope sheets and racing forms there on your desk. I'm quite an admirer of horse flesh myself.
You're quite a character, too, aren't you? Working on Sunday and all?
Well, you know how public opinion is. It goes right on, rain, shine, or Sunday.
Excuse me a moment. Oh, by the way, what's your name?
Marlowe, Philip Marlowe.
Okay, Mr. Marlowe. Stand still, because I'm not kidding about this gun. Now beat it back to whoever hired you and tell them they're being very clumsy about a very delicate situation. One more move like this, and they won't get another chance.
I knew Perdue meant business, so I left without an argument. Well, at least I had a repeat on the name, Elliot Perdue, and the occupation of bookie to toss at Helen Asher when I met her at 5 o'clock. In Bel Air, I eventually found 33 Lemonwood Drive. 200 yards of palm trees stood at rigid attention while I drove through the gate and up to the house. When the butler opened the door, he stared at me like my hat was on fire.
Yes, sir. Did you wish something?
Yes. Yeah, I'd like to see Mrs. Asher, please.
Mrs. Asher? Oh, good heavens. Mr. Stewart.
What's the matter, Robert? Who is it?
Why, sir,
I'm Philip Marlowe, Mr. Stewart, a private detective. I have an appointment with Mrs. Asher. Is she at home?
Oh, Mr. Marlowe, perhaps you can help. I don't know what to do. It's such a terrible thing.
What's happened?
Upstairs, not 5 minutes ago, Mrs. Asher shot herself.
Shot herself?
Please, if you'd come up with me.
Yeah, sure, of course.
I'm certainly grateful for your help, Mr. Marlowe. This is her room. She's in here. There.
Yeah. She's dead, all right. Shot herself in the left temple. Whose gun is that, Mr. Stewart?
Why, it's mine. I kept it in the desk downstairs.
Did you find her?
No, Roberts did. I was out in the hothouse working with my orchids. You see, I've been out of town. I just came in this morning on the super chief from Chicago, and I wasn't expected back until Wednesday.
Yeah, look, Mr. Stewart, do you mind telling me how well you knew Mrs. Asher?
Oh, very well indeed. Ever since the accident 3 years ago, she lived in my house under my care.
The accident?
Yes, that's how she got those scars on her cheek and neck. As you can see, my hands were burned at the same time.
Would you mind telling me about it?
Well, I was living in Canada at the time. One day, my wife Florence and I went to a camp near Quebec, and we met Helen Asher our first day there. She was a pathetic, lonely woman, a widow.
Oh?
That very night, while she was visiting us, the oil stove in our cabin exploded.
Oh.
Florence, my wife, was killed, and Mrs. Asher was severely burned. It was ghastly.
I can imagine.
Mrs. Asher had no one, so I thought the least I could do would be to care for her, since I knew the accident had been caused by sheer carelessness on my part.
You took over full responsibility for her?
Yes, I did everything I could think of, but she never quite got over the shock of that night, and now this. It's horrible.
Have you notified the police yet?
No,
you better do it right now.
Yes, I'll go right downstairs and call them.
The dead woman on the floor had been beautiful once. No doubt about it. This was my client's. And a certain $50 bill was burning a hole in my pocket. I wandered over to a writing table, and as I looked down, I noticed that the Sunday sheet had been torn off the memo pad. It bothered me. Tomorrow should mean nothing to a suicide, yet Mrs. Asher's memo pad showed Monday already. The sheet was blank, but on a hunch, I tore it off and stuck it in my pocket. I was about to turn away when I saw a book of matches from the Conga Club. So I picked that up, too, and then I left. I drove around for some time trying to figure things out. Then I went down to police headquarters to see one Lieutenant Ibarra.
It's suicide as far as we're concerned, Marlowe. Everything checks. Mrs. Asher was despondent and she killed herself. She didn't leave a suicide letter, but they don't always. How'd you get in on this?
Well, she paid me $50 in advance to air out a small-time bookie or worse named Elliot Perdue. Incidentally, what's the background on Arthur Stewart?
Oh, he's a big-money fashion designer. Started his business on his wife's insurance. She died in an accident in Canada.
Mm.
He did a lot for Mrs. Asher because he felt responsible.
Yeah, I know all that. But was she left-handed? Did Stewart come in on the super chief this morning, and was it the butler that found the body?
That's right. We checked it all.
Ah.
Hey, look, Phil, do you have any good reason to think this isn't suicide?
No, no, not really. It's just that $50 in advance that bothers me, I guess. Oh, by the way, I've got a piece of paper I'd like the boys in the lab to run a test on, okay?
Sure, Casey will fix you up. Marlowe, I figure suicide now, but I can always change my mind.
I went down the hall to the police laboratory and handed the blank page of the memo pad to Casey. 10 minutes later, he explained that the impression showed a left-handed person had written a number, Bradshaw 7, 711, with a wide point fountain pen, probably on the page just above the one I'd given him. Well, I thanked him, dropped 4 bits in the Christmas fund bottle, and found the phone. I dialed Bradshaw 7711 and waited.
Hello?
Hello? Who's this?
The man in the moon. Come up and see me some other time.
Hey, wait a minute. Wait a minute. I like your voice. And besides, 7711 is a very lucky number.
Uh-huh. 3 passes in a row. But don't let it fool you, Jack. The answer is no dice. Goodbye.
Yes, well. I gathered she was in no mood for playing, so I decided to be strictly business and dialed again. There was no answer. I let it ring for some time, but Miss Golden's voice obviously wasn't taking any more anonymous calls. Had left only the long shot, the book of matches I'd found on Mrs. Asher's desk. The Conga Club was on the Sunset Strip, so I drove out there, found a parking space on a side street nearby, and went in. I didn't know exactly what I was looking for, so I paid $1.10 for a scotch and soda worth 40 cents just to help pass the time. An amber spotlight was glistening down on a set of sequin contours that would have melted the ice age down to a fortnight. And she was singing.
For wherever my man is, I am his. Forever.
I knew it was Vanita, the Conga's featured songstress, and I knew something else, too. There was no mistaking that voice. She was the girl with a lucky phone number. I wrote her a note, called a waiter to the table to deliver it, and then sat back to watch her as she glided over and sidled into a chair opposite me.
It was your penmanship that intrigued me, Mr. Malone.
It was your voice and so forth, mostly the so forth, that got me, Vanita.
Would you care to decipher the Sanskrit you called a note? The waiter said you wrote it.
Sure. It says important business.
That's an idiom. If you wanted to talk Turkey, how would you translate it?
Do you know a woman named Helen Asher?
Not that I remember. Why?
Well, your phone number showed up on a memo pad. How do you account for that?
How should I know? Maybe she intended to call me up. Look, you're quite a handsome man, Mr. Marlowe. But you look silly with your nose bent. Why do you keep sticking it into other people's business?
Because besides being paid for it, it sometimes leads to meeting interesting and beautiful people. Present company included.
What do you want?
Mrs. Asher killed herself tonight.
Mrs. Asher's dead?
Yeah, yeah. And considering you said you didn't know her, you look very put out about it.
All right, Marlowe, you win. But let's not talk about it here. Finish your drink while I get out of this costume. Then meet me outside by the front door in 10 minutes.
When she headed for the back of the club, I headed for the front. I got out the door and down to my car just in time to see her leave by the stage entrance. She jumped into a yellow convertible, ripped down Sunset Boulevard, turned onto Doheny, and scraped to a halt in front of the Regent Apartments. At the door, a tall, sunburned man popped up from somewhere and intercepted her. It was Elliot Perdue. A short but hot argument took place, and apparently Perdue won, because they went in together. I found the name Benita Malone over the mailbox at number 5. And got to her apartment door just as the second round started.
No, I haven't changed my mind, Elliot.
I've been doing a little research since you threw me over, Benita. I've got you and your precious plans right here in the palm of my hand.
What are you talking about?
This little heart-shaped locket on this little golden chain.
Let me see
that. No. I'm not showing this trinket until just the right moment.
Listen, Elliot. I don't know what's brewing in that slimy brain of yours. But get this, if you try to monkey with my life again, so help me, I'll kill you. Now, get out!
Benita, would you be interested if I told you that I know Mrs. Asher's secret?
And would you be interested if I told you that Mrs. Asher killed herself tonight? That slows you down, doesn't it, bright boy?
Yes, but it doesn't stop me, beautiful. I'll be seeing you before you know it.
I ducked into an alcove and heard Benita slam the door on Purdue's coattails as he left. So, now I knew that Purdue, a locket, and Benita Malone added up some way to a bullet in the head for a scarred woman with a secret. I went back to my car and drove out to Stewart's house in Bel Air.
When you were here before, Marlowe, I was so upset I hardly realized you were a private detective. You had an appointment with Mrs. Asher. Had she hired you?
Yes, to investigate someone, but she didn't live long enough to give me the details.
Now, what sort of trouble could she have been in to have needed a private detective?
I don't know. But perhaps you can help me find out by answering a few questions.
Anything. Anything at all, Mr. Marlowe.
Does the name Elliot Purdue mean anything to you, Mr. Stewart?
Elliot Purdue? No, I'm afraid not.
How about Benita Malone?
Yeah, I've never heard of her.
You know anything about a heart-shaped locket on a gold chain?
A locket? A gold locket?
Yeah.
Mrs. Asher had a heart-shaped gold locket.
Where'd she keep it?
Well, upstairs in her jewelry box, I should imagine.
Come on, let's have a look, huh?
Yes. Right up these stairs here. This is her room, Marlowe.
I know. I was here once before.
Why? It's not here. It's not on her dressing table. Her jewelry box, it's gone, Marlowe. But you think that...
Elliot Purdue has it.
I can't understand this.
What's the locket like? What's inside it?
Just a picture. It was valued by Mrs. Asher because it was the only one she kept of herself the way she looked before the accident. Now, why would anyone else want that?
I don't know. But when we get that locket, we'll get a lot of answers along with it. Now I was more convinced than ever that Elliot Purdue, Benita, and the late Mrs. Asher's secret were all dangling from the same chain that supported the gold locket. I said goodnight to Arthur Stewart and started back for Hollywood. A moment later, I changed my mind and abruptly swung onto a shadowed side road and parked, lights out. It had suddenly occurred to me that the gallivanting Mr. Purdue might call on Stewart. And if so, I wanted to be on hand. Well, 40 minutes later, I was about to call off the cloak and dagger routine when I heard the sound of a powerful motor roaring out of Stewart's driveway. I looked up just in time to see a long black Nash whip by with Stewart at the wheel. From the speed of the car, I certainly wasn't going out for the morning papers. I decided to go back to the house and question the butler while I could have him to myself.
Oh, why, no, Mr. Marlowe. I haven't any idea where Mr. Stewart went. I only know that he had a telephone call, after which he dashed out of the house highly upset.
Well, maybe some sick friend needed sitting up with, huh? But tell me, Roberts, did you ever hear of a man named Elliot Purdue?
Oh, yes, sir. He called on Mrs. Asher here once or twice while Mr. Stewart was away on business.
When did you last see this Mr. Purdue, Roberts?
Yesterday morning, sir, about 10 o'clock.
And one thing more, did you ever see Mrs. Asher wearing a gold locket, a heart-shaped one?
Oh, quite often, sir. As a matter of fact, she asked me about it just yesterday morning, shortly after Mr. Purdue left. She couldn't locate it anyplace.
A singular coincidence, huh? Oh, by the way, what do you know about a singer named Benita?
Benita? I've never heard of her, sir.
Are you sure she's never been out here as Mr. Stewart's guest?
Why, I'm positive, sir. Mr. Stewart never has any ladies out here of any kind.
Oh? Doesn't that strike you as being strange, Robert? After all, Mr. Stewart's a very eligible widower.
Widower, yes, Mr. Marlowe, but philanderer, no. Good night, sir.
As I drove back to Hollywood, I tried to figure out where Arthur Stewart had gone. But I had about as much to work with as Gypsy Rose Lee after a third encore. And after discounting Benita's place in the Conga, there was only Elliot Purdue's house on North Ogden. 15 minutes later, I walked up to it, but the place was as dark and as quiet as the inside of a coffin. I was about to turn back to my car when suddenly I caught the reflection of a sliver of light bouncing off the glass in Mr. Purdue's living room. I found the back door lock easy to bluff. A moment later, I stepped into the living room.
Marlowe, how did you know I was here?
Mr. Stewart told me.
You're a liar. Arthur wouldn't...
Arthur?
Well, you see, Mr. Stewart and I...
Now it's Mr. Stewart, huh? Wait a minute. There's someone outside.
Purdue.
Put out your light. Now, when he finds you keep talking, say anything. I'll be behind the door. Here he is.
Well, Benita. What a waste of time, my dear. While you've been here rearranging my socks, I've been talking to your boyfriend with the locket safely tucked away right here in my breast pocket.
How clever of you. How absolutely ingenious.
To
bit late for nasty words between us, Benita, because possession of you was part of the bargain I struck with Mr. Stewart. You see, we... What are you staring at?
My big blue eyes, Pertu. Don't move or I'll blast you.
You'll do nothing? No! Get the gun, Benita. Now, Pertu, we'll play some more.
Now the gentleman's breast pocket. Ah, here it is, Benita. Safe and sound.
Which is just the way I want it, Phil.
What? My own gun. Why, you beautiful
the
snake.
The lock, Marlowe. Come on, I get nervous with one of these things in my hands. Throw it here. Thank you. Now, when I leave, Phil, don't come after me, because I'd hate to fill you full of little holes. Good night, dear.
When Benita stepped out of that house, I solemnly swore I wouldn't trust another woman for the next 100 years. A groan from the body on the floor brought me back to 1948 and Elliot Perdue. I knew that he had seen the picture in the locket, so I went to work on him. Come on, Perdue, snap out of it. Come on.
Huh? Oh, it's you, Marlowe.
Who'd you expect, St. Peter? What was in the locket, Perdue?
I don't remember.
Maybe a call on Lieutenant Ibarra will refresh your memory.
I doubt it.
Then we better start playing games again. We'll start with one called Slap Slap Perdue.
No, let me alone, Marlowe. Get your hands off me.
Well, you're ready to start singing, huh? All we need now is the right lyric.
No.
Come on, Perdue, talk.
Stop it, I'll talk.
Good. Now, why did Mrs. Asher kill herself?
Because she had a good reason.
Like what?
It's a long story.
Make it short.
Okay, Marlowe, here goes.
Lieutenant Ibarra speaking.
Marlowe Ibarra. There's a 5-minute-old corpse lying in his living room at 1903 North Ogden. Name is Elliot Perdue. 3 shots through a closed window. I was lucky.
Any description of the killer?
No, none. Now, look, Ibarra, right now I'm going after a songbird named Benita Malone at the Regent Apartments on Doheny. Will you cover me there without sirens?
Sure, Marlowe. I'll attend to it in person.
It was only a healthy centerfielder's peg from Perdue's house to Benita's. When I got there, the place was dark and a car wasn't in sight. I decided to try the Conga Club. But as soon as I walked in, I began to worry because if Benita had wanted to get rid of that locket, she'd have had enough time to bury it at Forest Lawn. But I didn't know Benita, because Miss Oomph herself was singing in the amber spotlight. And dangling from her soft white neck was the heart-shaped gold locket.
I love you, because he's wonderful. Because he's just my Bill.
When she caught my eye, she smiled like a maitre d', and the moment she was through with her song, she headed back in my direction. But before she got to me, I saw her give the high sign to an ape in a tuxedo. He looked at her and then across toward my table and left the room. I watched Benita glide across the floor in my direction. She was distinctly a thing of beauty.
Huh. Well, Phil, what do you think of my singing?
Oh, I'm just crazy about it. That and your jewelry. Especially that locket, family heirloom.
Mm-hmm. It was more or less handed down to me, generation to generation. That's an old Spanish custom.
Yeah, so I've been told. And I imagine tradition prohibits your parting with it, huh?
That's right. Unless, of course, someone with oodles of money offers me lots of it in exchange. Then naturally I'd be obliged to part with it.
I don't think you'd feel obliged to your mother on the second Sunday in May. Besides, I don't have oodles of money.
Oh, you should have told me that earlier. Goodbye, good looking.
Hey, wait a minute.
We couldn't do any business in a minute. And don't follow me if you want to stay pretty.
She pivoted on a spike heel and took off for a dressing room, and I knew that if I followed, I was scheduled for a nasty tete-a-tete with an ape in a tuxedo. When I made the lower floor and saw that the long corridor to a room was empty, I knew the setup. The ape would be on the other side of the door waiting. Benita still had my gun, so I got the nearest substitute for a blackjack, a full bottle of Paul Masson champagne. Then I walked noisily down the corridor as far as her door and knocked. Turned the knob slowly, kicked the door open, and stood clear. It worked. The ape's hairy hand was wrapped around my gun, and it came down in an arc that was never interrupted. And that left him off balance. The ape hit the floor, and before Benita had a chance to close her mouth, I ripped the locket from her neck, picked my gun up, and ran. I didn't stop until I collapsed against the store window. Then I opened up the locket. 2 minutes ran out of me before I realized what was wrong with the picture. Then I knew. Arthur Stewart's home in Bel Air was my next stop. Minutes later, I pulled up away from the place and parked. And keeping in the shadows, I approached the house where only the library and an upstairs bedroom showed any light. The library had French windows. When I moved up close, I was startled by the sight of a figure going through Stewart's desk. I stepped into the room and found it was my little friend, Benita. I've got my own gun again, Benita.
Phil.
Oh, doing a little dusting, honey?
Oh, don't be funny.
I'm not trying to. But how is it you're not upstairs helping Stewart pack?
Because I've already finished packing Mr. Marlowe, and don't turn around. It was well done, Benita.
Oh, fine. Sucked in by a little decoy sprinkled with sequins.
Never mind the prose, Marlowe. Just toss your gun on the couch over there. Now. That's better. You know, Marlowe, I can't say that I'm very sorry for you.
I don't expect condolences from a character who murdered a woman this afternoon and a man this evening.
You killed Mrs. Asher?
Yes, and that blackmailing scum Purdue as well. But both murders were very necessary, Benita. Even as Marlowe's here will be. Come over here, Benita, behind me.
Hurry, Arthur, let's get out of here.
Don't worry. And now, Mr. Marlowe, it's time for you.
Well, thanks, Benita. You swing a beautiful bookend. You know, I had you figured all wrong.
Now, don't mention it, dear. I heard the cops coming anyway.
You sweet child. We're in here, Ibarra, all of us.
Well, Marlowe, I figured you'd be out here when you didn't show up at that Songbird's place.
Well, what's this? A little man on the floor with a large bump on his head is Arthur Stewart, the man who killed Elliot Perdue to keep him from telling me the truth about Mrs. Asher, and the man who killed her this afternoon.
So Mrs. Asher didn't commit suicide after all.
No, but she wasn't murdered either. She died in that accident in Canada 3 years ago.
What are you talking about?
Well, the woman that Stewart killed here this afternoon wasn't Mrs. Asher. It was his wife, Mrs. Florence Stewart. You see, there must have been a mix-up in identifying the bodies of the two women at the time of the accident.
Mm-hmm.
Stewart and his wife had Mrs. Asher buried as Mrs. Stewart. Then they collected the insurance. Neat, huh?
Yeah. But what happened?
Yeah, it's simple. Stewart got bored with his scarred and unattractive wife, and he started running around with choice little numbers. Like Benita here.
Phil, honest, I didn't know a thing about this. Stewart told me that Mrs. Asher depended on him so heavily that she'd be crushed at his seeing another woman. But I didn't know she was his wife.
Marlowe, how do you figure this all out?
From a locket that belonged to the woman we knew as Mrs. Asher. It had a picture of Stewart and Mrs. Asher taken in dress clothes before she was scarred. Yet Stewart claimed that he and his wife had only met Mrs. Asher the day of the accident, and on a camping trip at that.
But, Phil, I saw the picture, too, and I didn't figure that out.
That's because you were too busy trying to figure just how much the locket was worth to Arthur Stewart, or to anybody, in cold cash. You were blinded by all the dollar signs in front of your eyes, baby.
Why, Phil, how can you say such things?
Now, Marlowe, just so I don't toss and turn all night, tell me just why you were hired in the first place.
Well, Ibarra, it goes something like this. When Perdue knew that he was losing Benita to Stewart, he decided to check up on the opposition. And he not only found out what he wanted to know, but he found out a lot of things, too, that he didn't want to know. Mrs. Stewart, the late Mrs. Asher, became suspicious of his questioning, and incidentally of her husband. So she sent for me.
Well, Marlowe, Stewart certainly had me fooled. I doped him out to be a very generous guy, a great benefactor who was doing the right thing for a lonely, unfortunate woman.
Yeah, looked like he had a heart of gold, all right. But a funny thing, Ibarra, in the end, it was this heart of gold, this locket here that got him. Mind if I keep it?
Not at all. You had a tough enough time getting hold of it. Good night, Phil.
Well, by the time I got back to my apartment on Franklin, the sky was beginning to fill with a soft gray of morning. I pulled the blinds down in my bedroom and sat down for a last cigarette. I'd mixed with a lot of funny people that day. But for some cockeyed reason, I kept thinking of Benita Malone, a girl who was no better than she had to be. Finally, I put her out of my mind, and I was about to turn off the desk lamp when I noticed my memo pad. Still read Sunday, which was understandable. But scrawled across the top sheet was a telephone number.
and I couldn't figure how it got there. It was written in crimson lipstick. Bradshaw 7. 7-Eleven.
Adventures of Philip Marlowe, created by Raymond Chandler, stars Gerald Moore and is produced and directed by Norman MacDonald. Featured in tonight's cast were Gloria Blondell, John Daner, Jack Moyles, and Ben Wright. Be sure to be with us again next week when Philip Marlowe says...
They were all after it. An importer, a beautiful woman, a nut, and a guy I couldn't figure out. But before we were through, one was in the hospital, two were in the morgue, and the fourth was waiting for the hangman. All that because of a blue burgonette, something I'd never even heard of before.
Dr. Fabian, the ship's doctor in cabin B-13, tells a new story of danger in far ports tonight... over most of the CBS network stations. Tonight's story, The Island of Coffins, is another original drama by John Dixon Carr, famed mystery writer. You can hear it when the ship's whistles sound outside cabin B-13.
The Adventures of Philip Marlowe, on Tuned to Yesterday from October 24th, 1948 on CBS. Closing out this hour of mystery on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Libnonier. It's been a pleasure.